Welcome to the Game of Thrones podcast, the officially unofficial podcast for Game of Thrones on HBO. I'm Jim.
I'm Aaron.
And today we're talking about Season 1, Episode 3, titled Lord Snow. Other than an offhanded comment that I think is a bit of a joke, I'm not sure exactly why this is called Lord Snow.
I think that's you got it.
Really? That's it?
Well, I mean,
that seems pretty insignificant.
One of the central arcs of it is John learning how to command.
Right.
Well, John learning not to be a douche.
Checking his privilege, yeah.
Yes, there you go. Checking his bastard privilege. Highborn bastard privilege.
Okay, so it's just a jab at him.
Yeah.
Which I got. I just thought, man, overall, that's pretty insignificant.
What else would you call it?
What do you mean?
The War for Cersei's Cunt? That would have been a pretty epic title, because you're like, my God, you sit up straight like, wow, you know what?
This is going to be a big episode.
let's see what kind of content warnings we're going to get here. But no, that would have been another title.
Like, My First Kill. There's that one.
Back Alley Sally.
sure.
Okay. Yeah, what do you call that? The anti-name game, when we just make shit up?
Yeah.
That's what you call 50% of bald move.
Anything before we get into the recap?
Yeah, correction to my correction, and I swear to God, if this doesn't stop, I'm just going to start referring to all filming locations as North Dakota. But I had a few concerned Scotsmen, a Brit, and a American write in and say that actually,
oh, Jesus,
a lot of the Winterfell scenes, especially in the pilot, the original pilot, and some survived into the actual pilot, were filmed at Doune Castle. I probably mispronounced that, which is in central Scotland near the Stirling District. And it's a really cool, impressive... you can definitely see why it could stand in for Winterfell. So the Scots get their due. I'm not going to read any of the emails because some of them are heated, but let's just all get along, people.
Okay.
Because that's the other thing is, like, you know, next it's going to be Croatia writing in, and then Spain. It's everybody wants
just
to claim.
It's all
North Dakota. That's from here on out. It's Bismarck. All scenes of King's Landing were filmed in Bismarck. That's all. I just want to update that to make sure everyone got their due.
Okay, then let's get into the recap. We start off with the Starks arriving at King's Landing, and Ned is immediately invited to a meeting with the Grand Maester. He decides not to change before he goes in there. Jaime's waiting for him in the throne room, though, before he can get back to the council chambers. And they talk about the Mad King killing Ned's father, and Ned essentially calls Jaime a coward for not stopping it, even though 500 other men stood around, didn't stop it, and also for serving as the hand while it's safe. And now here's Ned serving as the hand while...
Well, as the King's Guard.
And now here's Ned serving as the hand while...
It's safe.
Very unsafe for him.
Yeah, you know, it's funny because I always thought that Ned was a bit tough on Jaime, all things considered.
Everyone's tough on Jaime.
Given his
yeah.
age of when this happened and his inexperience and the fact that, mm-hmm. you know, if you buy into Jaime's narrative that he, you know, single-handedly slew a terrible king and spared a lot of the populace.
Mm-hmm.
But I guess there is a little bit, now that I'm on the second, or God knows how many times I've watched this, but on this time through, I'm actually finding that you served him well when serving was safe. Because I've often wondered, like, you know, if Jaime had killed the Mad King right before he killed his father and brother, would he still hate them and see him as... And I don't know that he would. Because that would be a principal stand against some kind of injustice, whereas... But I mm-hmm. also think... You know, even though I'm sympathetic to this view, I also think Ned's being unfair because you're in a position where there's 500 other great men in the room, including probably the commander of the Kingsguard that you're serving under, and this horrific thing is happening. Like, when do you break your vow? Do you break it at the first imprecation?
Mm-hmm.
Or do you finally, you know, you've had all you can stands, you can't stands no more? I thought that was... A little bit. I forgot about that. The scene and him saying, "Yeah, you served him when it was safe."
Yeah. So we haven't seen either of these guys fight yet. But Ned's a little older.
Sure.
Ned's talking a lot of shit about Jaime, and I get the impression that Jaime's really good with a sword. I don't know that Ned could take Jaime, frankly.
You
might want to tone it down.
My considered opinion would be that Ned would be toast. Yeah.
Okay.
He's not that great of a warrior, but. Who knows?
Here are the highlights coming up this week on Bald Move.
We've got lots of ongoing coverage this week, from book versus show comparisons for Hot D to the latest very special episode of Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? But there are a couple of main events this week you need to know about.
Firstly, we've got a brand new commission podcast out this Tuesday covering the Raid 2, sometimes subtitled Retaliation. If you're a fan of martial arts films, this is one you don't want to miss. Iko Uwais is a rising star in the action movie world, and it's easy to see why. Join us on Tuesday as we dive into the bigger, badder sequel to The Raid, try and figure out which is better.
Then on Thursday, we're covering the season finale of Hulu's excellent period drama, Shogun. We've been waiting all season to see what Toranaga-sama's plan is, or if he even has one. It all comes down to this, and we couldn't be more excited. Join us on Thursday for what's sure to be an epic Shogun season finale podcast, and to find out if we plan to cover any related materials.
You can find these and many other great podcasts by searching for Bald Move Pulp or Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app. We're getting geared up for the 6th annual Summer Badass Fest. And while we're working on a slate of apex badass films to enjoy, we've got an early action-packed announcement to make.
Just like last year, we're kicking off Badass Season with a live movie watch and podcast recording. We've rented out a theater for connoisseurs of action films and Bald Move fans that just want to have a great time.
Unlike last year, this year's movie is top secret. Hush, hush. No hints, except it's incredibly badass. It stars an absolute icon of the genre. We're willing to bet most of you haven't seen it, and it's going to be an incredible viewing experience with a packed house of Bald Movers.
Those of you who came to last year's screening of Total Recall know what a party it was, and those of you who didn't, now's your chance to experience it. Meet me and Jim, order some custom movie-themed drinks at the theater's full bar, then watch us record the full podcast for the movie. We reserved a venue over twice the size as last year, but seating is still limited.
It's happening Friday, June 21st at 7 p.m. in our hometown of Cincinnati. Get full details and buy tickets at baldmove.com/live.
Cincinnati's actually a pretty great city to visit, and we've got lots of details for side adventures on our event page as well. The Reds are playing the Boston Red Sox in their fantastic Riverside Stadium. The thrills of Kings Island just minutes away, and I'll be leading a kayak trip down the scenic Little Miami River on Saturday.
Again, get full details and get your tickets now on our Badass Fest 6 page at baldmove.com/live.
Is it appropriate to shed any light on this whole thing with Ned's father? And
I don't think so, because I feel like it's the exact circumstances of the death at King's Landing is supposed to be a mystery that it kind of evolves and colors your opinion of the two men. So yeah, I think we should kind of keep that close to our vest. Okay. But yeah, and the other thing is, like, you know, man, a lot of the early goings of the Game of Thrones podcast was a lot, you know, in the first couple seasons, it was a popular topic to debate the swordsman of the day and all that stuff. I don't really want to get into that. So I'm not talking shit about Ned. I think it's fair to say that Ned is a commander. Okay. He's not exactly a great swordsman.
Right.
Like, I think he's a good leader and he's a good battlefield commander.
Good father, good husband, it seems. Or, as good of a husband as he can be when he's leaving his family.
As good as a father
dust.
You could be when you've got a bastard waiting in the wings.
But like, specifically with Arya and stuff. Yeah. Like, he's always seems fair. He doesn't seem like he's pushing his kids in a certain direction or anything.
Right.
I don't know. A little more progressive than Ned Stark. Anyway, he goes back to the council chambers where he meets with the Grand Maester. Pycelle, that's his name. Renly, Varys, Littlefinger, just a whole bunch. The whole crew there.
Yeah, a lot of main characters are being introduced here. Renly, of course, is Robert's younger son.
Right.
And I thought it's interesting to see that it looks like Ned pretty much hates everybody except for Renly. He's tight with Renly. He's like, hey, I remember you.
Gives him a big hug, yep.
You knucklehead. Varys he doesn't like. He kind of brings them up. Oh, we were praying for Joffrey's crow. Oh, pray for the butcher's son.
Right.
Littlefinger, you know, we already find out that there's a little bit of torch carrying for his wife, but that's all. That's never a line you start off. It's like, oh.
No.
Yeah, I used to be the dude that jerked off thinking about your wife. Remember me? Right. I'm the little wormy guy. That's not cool. And then Great Maester, you don't know why he hates him, except for you served another. Come on, Ned. That's a bullshit reason not to like someone.
You just distrust him, I guess. I don't know.
Yeah. Well, maybe there's some facts that we don't know.
Maybe.
Maybe there's some skullduggery here.
There's a fact that Ned doesn't know, and that is Robert is a terrible king. He's out doing whatever the fuck he's out. He's slapping whores or drinking wine or whatever he's doing. He's not there for the meeting. The council says, hey, we're $6 million in debt because of this guy.
Sure.
John Arryn tried to talk to him, but he didn't really listen.
I love how Robert eventually invited him and said, come be my hand and help me whore and drink myself into early grave. And then he gets there and he's like, I thought that was just Robert, you know,
yeah,
shit talking. I had no idea that it was actually true. He's distraught.
Yeah, and he's bankrupting the kingdom here. And they want to put on a tournament, but Ned's like, no, that's going to cost far too much money. We don't have it. Let me talk with the king before we do any planning.
I thought Renly's line reading of the counting coppers sounded very Dickens street urchin. Counting coppers is what he called it, governor. I was like, Renly, come on.
Okay.
Gonna be pushing his nose against the window, wanting invited in next.
Oh man, it's a bad scene. You gotta cut that shit out before it starts.
Yeah.
So we find out that Brandon Stark. Have we seen Brandon Stark?
Why
on screen? I'm mentioning him because Littlefinger says he sliced me. He basically sliced him up.
Yeah, Brandon
from the nuts to the collarbone.
More backstory, but Brandon is the eldest Stark son that went to King's Landing, was murdered with Ned's father.
Okay, so we obviously haven't
and
seen.
And Bran is actually named after. Well, I mean, they're all named after Bran, like this ancient Brandon who supposedly built Winterfell and the Wall. But yeah,
right. Yeah, but he, you know, he chose Catelyn, he says. He talks a lot of shit about what Catelyn means to him, mm-hmm. and, like, right in front of Ned.
I don't know what to talk, because, like, I could tell the whole story about, you know, and all this, but, like, I'm not sure. I'm pretty sure it comes up later.
Well, he tells part of the story position. Here.
Yeah.
About some kind of, I don't know, we find out later that maybe he was buttering Ned up a bit here. He's like, look, I care about Catelyn.
So weird way later to butter on, one up.
Well, I think he's just making a point. He's not buttering him up. That was okay. Misspeaking. But he's making a point, like, I care about Catelyn.
Yeah.
And I've got the scars to prove it.
Sure.
So that later on, when he talks about this dagger and how he's going to, you know, get to the bottom of it and all that stuff, it maybe makes sense to Ned.
Yeah.
Even though Ned still distrusts him.
Yeah, I just, like, if you wanted to butter the guy up or get in his good, like, there's probably other ways you could say that. Like, oh, yeah, she used to be, I had a crush on her.
Right.
You know, not...
Yeah, boyhood crush. Can you blame me? Like, that sort of thing, right?
But we're all men now. Well, I've moved on. And,
sure.
Know, I literally,
I've got all my orders.
I literally own hundreds of women, so...
Yeah. So we go over to Cersei patching up Joffrey's arm and kind of rewriting the history of this direwolf encounter in Joffrey's head, kind of as a lesson to him. Like, look, you are the person who makes the history here.
Mm-hmm.
People will believe what you say. She also teaches him a lesson about ruling the kingdom and kind of sets up the Starks as their enemies, which Joffrey was feeling all along.
Yep.
And basically everyone else. It's us or no one.
Yeah, it's funny because she says she simultaneously trains him to have an inflated sense of his own importance, but also tries to then reel it in. Like, well, you know, just because you're king doesn't mean you can do anything you want.
Yeah. Yeah, she's got a weird opinion of power.
Yeah, the world would be exactly as you want it to be. Well, I think the Northerns have too much power, and I want a garrison and blah, and have a standing army. It's like, well, come on, you can't have the world exactly what you want. Whatever gave you that idea?
We're talking about within the castle walls here, Joff.
Well, in the lesson, as always, Cersei's an idiot.
Right.
And bad at everything, including imparting any kind of moral instruction to one's children.
Yeah. She seems to be maybe slightly better at it than Joffrey, because Joffrey doesn't realize, hey, I can't rule a kingdom the way I'm explaining here.
Yeah, but
I can't just march
never forget,
over
Cersei
everyone.
Cersei was raised by Tywin fucking Lannister. Joffrey's raised by Cersei. So,
yeah.
Like, you know, they're if she's better at it, it's just because she's a terrible parent.
Yeah, it's the phone game, right? Like, she's right. telling Joffrey everything that she learned from Tywin, which is barely remembered.
She wasn't really listening, you know? Right. She was like, I just see her, like, twirling her hair and chewing gum, you know?
Whatever, Dad.
Uh-huh.
Okay, Arya's practicing stabbing Joffrey. She's sitting at the table there, stabbing it. Ned comes in and sends her to her room and then gives Sansa a doll from the royal doll maker. Person who makes Myrcella's dolls.
Which I gotta say,
princess.
Shit quality.
Yeah, well, it's medieval times.
I've seen the Hound has an articulated wolf skull on his helmet,
true.
And they got a corncob doll with like a clay face carved on it. And that's the best you can. That's what the princess gets.
Because everybody's focused on making armor.
Mm.
Like, armor is so much more important than dolls. So, like, the real shit craftsmen are working on those dolls.
Well, it's also patriarchy. You know, that Joffrey's playing with, like, super fucking Valyrian steel He-Man figures.
He's got Transformers.
Have like, combat or swivel kung fu grip and all that stuff. And they get the corncob dolls.
They should make a Hound Transformer.
Well, there is a Transformer named Hound, point of fact.
Right, but it turns into Gregor. Like, just wait, he's the mountain. Sandor, sorry.
Yeah, that would be a boring ass toy. It's a mountain that transforms into a humanoid robot. Oh, a dog?
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah. Turns from a dog into Sandor.
My experience with Transformers is the more desperate the difference between the final shapes, the more unwieldy the toy.
Yeah. The easier they are to break. And
yeah. Or they just look, their proportions are fucked up because those animators don't give a shit when they're doing the they're just like, fucking fudge it. But when you got a real 3D thing, no, unless you grew up in Harry Potter land, there's no hiding that.
Well, Sansa's right. She hates the doll. It's a shit doll. She hated it. And she runs off to her room.
I haven't played with dolls since I was 8. Which, you know, come on, Ned. You should. A dress might have gone better.
Yeah.
Like a
yeah,
really
she's
nice.
She's trying to be a woman full grown here. You need to.
Do you think that the hint is that maybe Ned has not been as involved in his daughter's life, his lives? Because.
Could be. Yeah.
Because look at Arya. She apparently got no. Although she was a fair shot with a bow, so maybe she'd get some combat training.
Mm-hmm.
But she's wasting away doing needlepoint.
Right.
And Sansa hasn't played with dolls for, like, 5 years, and Ned apparently is ignorant of both of those facts, and maybe, like...
I guess so.
But I don't know. I don't know how much of that is just, you know, we're supposed to think Sansa's a spoiled brat.
I think it's not so much that she's a spoiled brat. To me, it's more like she's trying to be more grown up. Like, she's wanting to get married, she's wanting to, like...
Right.
Be her own person at this point.
Right.
And, you know, kind of push toward what her life is going to be rather than what it is now.
Right.
And this is representative of
that.
Well,
the thing that sticks in my craw is that what she's punishing her father here for is the death of her wolf.
Right.
Which is entirely her fault. Now, I think Ned is also right when he tells Zarya, he's like, look, she was drugged before the king.
What's she to do?
What do you do? And, like, Arya, of course, says, we just fucking tell the truth. It's really easy.
Yeah, Arya's like, I got principles,
right.
and they cannot be violated.
Yeah, she's got needlepoint. I have needle. I'm better. So say we all.
So Ned goes to see Arya in her room. She's playing with needle. Ned sits her down and he examines the
sword. I like
how
she opens, she greets her father at the door with naked steel.
Yeah.
Like, it's almost a challenge.
I was like, what? Is he even going to look at that sword?
Yeah, yeah.
But yeah, he sits her down, he checks out the sword, and Arya's pretty sad about the butcher's boy getting killed and angry at Sansa for lying.
And feels personally responsible, too, for her, because her, you know, it's one of those things where now she's had enough time that, you know, if I did just do the needle point and I wasn't such a fucking tomboy, then Micah wouldn't have died.
Yeah, fair point. Ned tries to explain that the family needs to stick together, and he gives her the sword back and tells her to learn how to use it.
Yeah.
Which I think surprises her, you know? It does surprise her. She's like, really? I get to keep it?
Yeah.
She could probably do some needlepoint with that, yeah? Put some thread on there and just go to work.
She could, I don't know, maybe
needlepoint
like...
Needlepoint
for a sail, like a main sail for a ship. Because you'd have some pretty thick thread and some pretty thick needle here.
It's true.
I like this because it's essentially Ned trying to explain difficult things to both of his daughters and having mixed success with both.
Yeah. And I feel like Arya gets it at the end of this. Like, this is some good parenting because...
good parenting.
He doesn't crack down on her and, like, try and punish her for, you know, things that that she really wants to do. He understands that, and he's not trying to push her in a direction.
Yeah.
As much as, you know, a medieval type father can.
Right.
Anyway, Bran is laying in bed, and an old woman tries to tell him a boring story. He wants to hear a scary one instead. So she starts telling him a story about White Walkers. And it starts to get the blood pumping. And then Rob interrupts him, dismisses all of her stories, says she's an old crazy woman. Rob confirms that Bran's legs are kaput, and Bran says he'd rather be dead.
Yeah. A couple of things. The Sir Duncan the Tall she references is a reference to the short stories and novellas that Martin has published about Sir Duncan. You can actually read it. There's a collection I got for Christmas called The Hedge Knight, or A Knight in Westeros is what it's called. And I guess there's a several more from that. But there, if you can't get enough Game of Thrones or A Song of Ice and Fire, you can always try that. And I think there's some graphic novel series, too, where they're illustrated. But they're pretty cool. But they're straightforward tales of heroics, it seems. They're not quite as nuanced and certainly as dark. It's like The Hobbit to The Lord of the Rings. But I love this scene. I love, you know, Bran goading her into telling the story and her, like, kind of refusal that's not a refusal. And she's, you know, the sweet summer child, which is the patronizing phrase that all the book readers used with the fucking...
Yeah.
Show watchers, oh, you sweet summer child, you think this is going to be happy. But yeah, when she like sets her face and is like, fears for the winter, when the women smothered the babies and the tears froze in the cheeks, it's like, if she had broken into that like Pee-wee's Big Adventure, Large Marge, the semi-driver, it right. would have fit tonally. Because and Bran's kind of like shrinking into the covers. It's
yeah,
a great scene.
I mean, I think Bran's excited by it. Bran wants a little adventure. He wants some danger, and... You know, he's not going to have use of his legs, so that's right out the window. And now he doesn't know what to do with himself.
Right.
It's unfortunate that, you know, a kid this young would have that taken away from him.
Right.
Also, I do like the way that they shoot a lot of this. There are several times in this episode where they just use these push-ins on the camera where... One's on that old lady, as she's telling the story about the White Walkers, and it's real good. It gives it an ominous feel. Later on, they do it with Catelyn and Ned as Catelyn's leaving King's Landing. But I don't know, some good cinematography in general. So Catelyn shows up at King's Landing, where the guards meet her and take her to Littlefinger's brothel. Kat's pissed about it, but he did it to hide her, and she kind of gets that by the end of it. Then Varys joins them and asks for the dagger of the assassin. He doesn't know whose it is, but fortunately Littlefinger does. He says he lost it in a bet to Tyrion Lannister. So there's some implication that maybe Tyrion Lannister hired this assassin to come kill Bran.
Now, from what I knew of the characters, I found this assertion dubious at best when I first saw this.
Okay.
I'm like, right. What? Tyrion assassin? That's what?
Why? What? The real question is, why would Tyrion do it?
Right. And what also, does he have to gain? Since we see him in this episode interacting with Jon and learning about... Like, nothing in his manner suggests that he would do something like that.
Right. Which makes you think Littlefinger's lying. Now,
yeah.
To what end? Why would Littlefinger lie?
Or there's something else to the piece that where there's some other actor that's, you know, this is going to be some kind of mystery that has to be unfolded. But right now, I always felt like, oh, well, this is a clear... This is bullshit. There's no way...
Right.
Tyrion did that.
Yeah, doesn't seem within his character.
The other thing we're supposed to really... This scene really kind of sets up, and it works really well, even for someone, or maybe especially for someone that's watched everything. It's like, how good Varys is as the Master of Whispers. Like, how the fuck did he know? Like... Only the people that were in the Godswood there, in Kate's small council, Kat's small council that she called, knew about the true purpose and who's coming and all that kind of stuff. I'm still scratching my head.
Yeah, no, but it really does set him up as the guy with all the knowledge, and it helps because, you know, Littlefinger has a certain amount of knowledge here, but he also says, like, I'm surprised that you don't know, because you know everything.
Right,
So, yeah, it works really well.
What did you think of Littlefinger when you first saw him? Because I'd only seen this guy as Mayor Carsetti from The Wire.
Me too, yeah.
And he's, you know, that's the thing is, like, Mayor Carsetti is a complicated character because he's kind of, I don't know, a compromised hero, or he tries to be a hero, mm-hmm. but he just, you know, nothing good happens in Baltimore, apparently.
Right.
And he just kind of gets consumed by the political machine. I thought it was a great casting choice. Because yeah. he's kind of good at playing those characters who you're just not quite sure about.
Yeah, he has the face you don't know if you trust.
And right off the bat, you're just not quite sure about this guy.
Absolutely. Then we go to John up at the wall. He's kicking ass. He's just breaking noses and stabbing people as Tyrion watches. They're kind of training in the yard there.
Mm-hmm.
And then Jorah Mormont complains that the men's training is going slowly and then hands Tyrion a letter for John. That we don't see what it says.
It literally, and pass it around to all the other black brothers. We want to all read it before we give it to him.
Right.
I get the Mormont might crack it open and read it because like he's the Lord Commander, but yeah. like what the fuck, just giving it to Tyrion?
Yeah, why does he do that?
I don't know. I thought it was very bizarre the second as I was watching it. Like, just everyone read John's mail, I guess.
Give it to Alistair to give to
John,
right?
I wouldn't even fucking
like,
do that.
Yeah, just give it to John yourself.
It's
real silly. I don't know what he's doing, but unless you have anything else to say, it looks like John has been well trained,
and also looks like that this Alistair Thorne guy is kind of an asshole. The one that's the train, he's the drill,
big tall blonde guy.
Yeah, he's the drill with the guy liner. He's the drill instructor, and you know, you think like, what an asshole. He's trying to goad all these guys against John and talking about him growing up in a castle, spitting down at the likes of you.
Yeah.
And just as you're like, man, what an asshole, Jorah Mormont says, well, you know, you need a guy like that to turn a bunch of thieves and rapists into men of the Night's Watch. Like, okay. Yeah, that tracks. That makes sense.
Yeah, but then you also need a Tyrion, right? Like,
yeah.
You can't just have an Alistair, otherwise people start killing each other. But if you've got a Tyrion there to kind of, you know, explain why these people hate each other
right.
and try and bring them together,
right.
then it helps.
I wonder if they get one sacrificial lamb per class.
Probably,
like
yeah.
it's like, you know, painting a red dot on a chicken and they all just peck him to death and then they all feel like badasses.
Is it always the best one?
Like, well, that's the thing.
Like, this guy's kicking all your asses. Let's
right,
kill him.
Right. But by doing that, instead of having one badass and 12 idiots, you've got now 12 semi-badasses.
Okay.
And one dead badass. I wonder. Because it does seem like their attrition rate is 50% if mm-hmm. you take literally them at their words.
Right. Okay.
So, like, life's cheap up at the wall.
We go back over to King's Landing, where Pycelle gives Ned a letter from Winterfell. And Littlefinger comes in and says he should share the news with his wife, which confuses Ned. He's like, what are you saying?
Mm-hmm.
What are you talking about?
Mm-hmm.
He starts to get a little angry. And then Littlefinger leads him to where Kat is staying in the brothel. And you know, Ned attacks him, and he's, like, ready to kill him for the insult until Kat pops her head out and says, hey, up here.
Which is filmed very funny.
What
like,
do you
that's
mean?
A funny, just her popping
oh,
her
yeah.
head out, and it's, like, you know, bordering on a Benny Hill skit.
Sure.
Between that and the back alley Sally, I thought this was a funnier than usual episode of Game of Thrones. This
yeah,
is probably Game of Thrones at its funniest, honestly.
I think so. Early Tyrion stuff is always real funny, too.
But it's dry and ironic. It's not like, you know,
I like that. Yeah.
Cat popping out, boing,
right.
like a cuckoo clock or something.
Sure.
And then Littlefinger mugging like, oh, these Starks, quick tempers, slow minds.
Yep. Great. Love it. Like, we don't really need to, as an audience, stick around for that remark, but it's fun.
Yeah. He also, he gives really good choking. Like he has a really okay. good, like, you know, his eyes kind of bugged out and focused
Sean
in two
Bean
different directions.
Sean Bean doesn't stage choke.
No,
Sean Bean actually chokes you when he chokes
All the Seans.
You.
Sean Connery doesn't stage eat. If he's,
he
if he's got a plate of pork chops in front of him, he's going to eat the fucking pork chops.
Uh-huh.
Sean Bean, if he's got a throat to choke, he's going to choke the throat. He doesn't know how.
And Sean Michael Scott will really
It says in the script,
monkeys.
I choke him. It doesn't say I act like I choke him. It says I choke him.
He's a method actor. What do you want?
Do you want me to act like a joke? Put it in a script. And he stomps off.
So the guys whose asses John kicked earlier corner him in the armory and put a knife to his throat. Then Tyrion comes in and threatens to put all of their heads on spikes, and they back off. Tyrion uses the stories of how each man came to be at the wall to kind of teach John a lesson about the advantages that he's had in life and... you know, his privilege, and then gives him a letter saying, hey, Bran woke up.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I feel like Tyrion's been trying to teach Jon these lessons. I don't know what made him necessarily take Jon under his wing, other than he's a bastard and an outcast.
I think that's it.
And
yeah,
really, he just feels some camaraderie with this guy because they've both been shit on.
Yeah, no.
They're both royalty who've been shit on.
The royalty angle even makes it stronger. They're literally peers, and their fathers have rejected them and spurned them for different reasons. But,
right.
You know, that's something like, hey, you know, what if I had your body? Like, I wonder if it's some of that, like, you know, like if I can
and
somehow
skill with the sword. And
yeah, like I'm a dwarf, so all I have is my mind. You seem like you're reasonably intelligent, and you got a full size body. That's, you know,
It's almost like Tyrion's body is the thing holding him back, and Jon's brain, Jon's mind, is the thing holding him back.
It's like, not as even because I don't think Jon. Well, I don't know. Jon, he's dumb as any other male Stark.
It's pretty dumb.
Which we'll come to appreciate. They tend to be dumb. But what do you call that? Like the social order holding him back? Like his preconceived notion of what he can do and be?
Right. That's why.
Because of the society's expectations?
Sure. Whereas if he could just kind of get over that, he might be, not throwing his life away at the wall, I guess.
Right.
Which seems a pretty rash thing to do. And even... Is it this scene or is it later on where he's like, look, nobody told me what it was going to actually be like up here. Nobody cared enough.
Right.
Except for you, Tyrion.
Yeah.
Like, he seems a little bit like he's made a mistake there.
Because at this point in the story, before he's kind of turned things around and made some friends, it is like, man, there are no heroes here. Like,
yeah.
There is nothing dashing or daring or, you know, I've even seen a grumpkin nor a snark nor even a wildling. So what the hell am I doing here? This isn't.
Right. What you have seen is maybe the only elevator in Westeros, though.
Mm.
Like, is there anything else like this in all of Westeros?
Probably not. But, you know, it's kind of like if you sign up, you volunteer to go into the army or the Marines, and you think, you know, you've heard all these stories.
Travel the world, right.
Then you show up, and it's like fucking Charlie Sheen's company and platoon,
mm-hmm.
and they're just smoking dope, and they got, you know, going around half naked, and it's like, what the, this isn't any kind of
right.
This isn't military
the noble,
tradition I'm familiar with. Yeah.
Heroic thing that I thought I was getting into.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, no, it's... You know, he's getting a rude awakening here. But, you know, Tyrion's also taken him under his wing, and he's trying to teach him lessons, trying to keep him from getting killed here and bring him together with his fellow brothers.
Yeah.
And you know, hearing that Bran's awake, I think, is a little bit of a shot in the arm for his positivity. Anyway, we go over to Littlefinger, promising to try to keep Ned alive while they work on resolving the Bran/Dagger situation.
Right.
Kind of figure out what to do about that, because they can't very well just go accusing the Lannisters straight up. And then Cersei goes to Jaime to worry aloud about Bran waking up, and Jaime isn't worried but promises to kill anyone who objects. I don't know, just a real quick scene. They're getting all touchy-feely on each other again. Kind of grosses me out.
I also think it's interesting how detached Jaime is from his children. Like, Cersei cares for her. You see in this episode that she cares for her children, at least Joffrey, in her way. Mm-hmm. But Jaime, when he's saying, like, I'm going to kill everyone until you and I are the only people left in the world, like, he is completely wrapped up in Cersei.
Yeah.
And for whatever reason has kind of... you know, divested his fatherly feelings for his children. I think this is evidence of that. Early evidence.
Yeah. Then we go back to Ned telling Catelyn he'll take care, that he'll take any proof he finds to the king. He's going to continue on the case and I guess work a little bit with Littlefinger there. And then she takes off for Winterfell once mm-hmm. again. Not a lot more to say about that. There's King Robert asking Sir Barristan about his first kill and kind of talking about his own. And they run out of wine, and he sends Lancel Lannister out to get more. And then at the same time pulls Jaime into the room to tell the story of his first kill, which we find out was the Mad King. It was not the Mad King. It was some kid on the battlefield that he cut the head off of. And then Rob asks what the Mad King said when Jaime stabbed him in the back, and Jaime says, burn them all.
This is an interesting scene, because you can tell that King Robert, for sport, likes to take down Lannisters with Peg.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, oh, Lancel, gods, what a stupid name. And then get your Kingslaying cousin in here, Kingslayer.
Right.
And I think that what he wanted to hear most of all was his first kill was King Aerys. And when Jaime was like staring away from that, and even Barristan Selmy, this distinguished Lord Commander, has a measure of respect for Jaime, which I think is super curious given his moniker, the Kingslayer.
Mm-hmm.
But it's like, well, you know, before you were a shitty Kingslayer, you were something there. And that was kind of pissing off Robert, so he steers it right back to what he really wanted to do, which is slap him around for being a Kingslayer again.
Right. So Barristan has been around in this organization for a long time, right?
Yeah.
Back when the Mad King was still the king.
Sure.
So I imagine that he has probably understood that the Mad King was, in fact, mad.
Sure.
And that maybe his respect for Jaime comes from that,
mm-hmm.
that he was maybe closer to the thing, and he could see that Jaime wasn't just a Kingslayer. He was doing something else for the realm, you know?
It is weird, though, to think that Robert is so openly provoking Jaime Lannister as the Kingslayer when he is guarding himself as the king.
Okay, right.
Like, how do you think the second king you kill is harder or easier?
Right.
Once you break the seal on the whole Kingslaying thing.
If you want Kingslayer, fine. I'll show you Kingslayer.
Yeah, right,
just
right.
Off with your head.
Right.
Sure. No, maybe not the wisest move, but then we find out that Rob isn't the wisest king.
That's so bizarre. Like, I've read some articles about, like, what it's like to be a Secret Service person and, like, you know, that they have, like, private thoughts about, you know, some of the presidents they like more than others. And
oh, sure.
Like, but you still, at the end of the day, have to take bullets for them. And I think that's interesting to see that, like, Barristan sitting there watching one of his brothers be abused and the scorn. And what an unworthy king Robert is.
Yeah.
Like, he's the worst fucking king.
Seems like it, yeah.
And, like, what a bummer that must be.
Right. Yeah, I don't know what Barristan thought about the Mad King, but I don't know that he has that much respect for Robert either.
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting. And I like the performances from everybody in this.
Yeah. Then we move on to Dany asking Jorah where the Dothraki get their slaves. Jorah says, basically, they take them as tribute, or sometimes they want to battle and they take them that way. Dany stops the procession to just wander off into the fucking grass for some reason. This grass that's supposed to be deadly and is going to take over the world.
I don't think this is the ghost grass they're talking about.
It's not?
No, I think this is what you call the Dothraki seas.
Okay. Viserys finds her and threatens her. A Dothraki dude whose name I don't know.
Jacaro, I think is his name.
Jacaro? Okay. Chokes him with a whip until Dany says to release him. And then Viserys orders Jorah to kill that dude, that Jacaro dude, but he's completely ignored.
I love the performance of Dany's handmaiden, Eerie, when she's like explaining she doesn't want her brother killed, and Jacaro looks at her like, for real? And she goes like, eh. You know, like, eh. What are you going to say? They're fucking Westerosi.
Right.
But this is, the worm is beginning to turn.
Beginning?
And well, that's the thing.
I feel
the
like
worm
this
turned.
Is the turn.
The worm turned, and Viserys doesn't realize it.
Okay.
And, like, he gets up after being, like, almost choked to death with a whip, still spouting threats and nonsense. Like, he's just the worst. He's the fucking worst.
And then his eyes bug out when they tell him to walk.
I know I just said that Robert's the worst king, but in so much as this guy is a king, he is the worst.
Yeah, he really is. And it doesn't look like he has any power anymore.
Right.
Like, he thought, you know, he was going to somehow take the Dothraki and conquer Westeros. That doesn't seem to be the thing anymore.
No.
I don't know where they're marching to, though. Where are they marching?
I know, but you don't know yet. So
it'll be
revealed in the fullness of time.
Sounds good.
I think the other thing is there's some cute stuff in the book where, because they took his horse away. It's like, no, you walk. The Dothraki had this nickname for him, Cal Rahe Mar, which is the Sorefoot King. They started, like, laughing behind his back because that's what, like, the men rode horses, the slaves and sure. the attendants would walk. So it was like not just a punishment, but also them pissing on him.
Yeah. Okay. John takes the elevator to the top of the wall where he finds Benjen, and John looks out north off the wall and kind of, you know, takes it all in. It's the first time he's ever seen the north.
Yeah.
And I guess not a lot of people have seen this, so it's a sight to behold. Benjen tells him that he's headed north to look into some disturbing reports, as he calls them. John wants to go, but Benjen says, basically, you haven't earned it yet. You got to stay here. Even though you're better than everybody else, or at least you think you are. Better at sword fighting, anyway.
Yeah. I think it's... So, what I said in the first episode about the backstory behind, the brash young ranger, that he was a noble-born third son, and that he kind of pressured Mormont into being the ranger, they're going out and leading this ranging party. I took that, and I took those eyes into this scene, and I wonder if what Benjen says about you got to earn, if that's like a new policy. Like, Mormont's like, no more of this shit. Like, Benjen, I know your nephew's going to bounce up to you and want to go, and fuck it. No, I'm not going to have any more inexperienced whelps getting killed up there.
Right.
Again, none of that's in the script or even in the novels, but it's a little thing I've kind of pieced together. Because it's obviously not true, since the other thing was...
Okay.
I don't know what I'm trying to say here.
I mentioned it earlier, what's with this being the only elevator in all of Westeros? Like, shouldn't they have elevators up to, like, towers and shit in King's Landing? Like, I've never seen... I've watched 6 seasons of Game of Thrones now. I've never seen another elevator. What the hell?
Well...
They rely on foot power a lot to get them around and to get them up to places. And
is it the fact that it's just like treacherous? Like, you got ice and snow, and you'd have your attrition rate would be 99% because you'd lose a guy every day slipping on the staircase and whatnot.
Maybe. I would think they could like hollow out some of that wall, build a staircase up it.
I bet they do have elevators.
I would think
on the wall, because like if you want to get like a big. You know, one of those scorpion-typed crossbows or a barrel of oil to set on fire. Like, you cannot carry that up staircase or ladder. You have to have some kind of freight elevator.
Okay. I've just never seen it. I would like to see more of the medieval tech.
It did also look like, to me, I've always thought that not only is that just an elevator, but it is like a switchback kind of staircase to the side of it.
Oh, is there?
So maybe this is John's Tinderfoot status, that he's riding the fucking elevator. Oh, too good to take the stairs, are we?
Right. So Tyrion and the guy named Yoren are talking about the strangest things they've ever eaten. I guess Yoren ate some bear balls.
Mm-hmm.
Benjen comes in and shuts down the revelry with a heavy dose of Night's Watch reality. Tyrion says he admires the Night's Watch, but... he doesn't believe in the legends about what's north of the wall. And Benjen leaves, and Tyrion suggests that Yoren and he share the road since he's headed to King's Landing as well. Apparently doing a lot of recruiting from the dungeons of King's Landing.
Yeah, Yoren is their recruiter / jailer.
Yeah.
Seems like a fun guy.
Yeah, that Benjen too. What a
riot.
Probably
the best job at the wall too, right?
Recruiting?
Yeah. Well, you get on a regular basis, you get to ride all the way to King's Landing where it's warm, where you're going to get, you're going to do some eating and drinking, you know, no other Black Brothers around, so maybe you can do some whoring too.
Right. Yeah. I mean, any opportunity to get away from the wall, south,
probably
away from the wall.
Good opportunity.
Is probably, you want to take that. And that, you know, that's why Benjen's such an angry prick. He's sent north of the wall constantly. It's one of those rangers. So moving on to there's a lot of comedy in this scene that I like. Just the repertoire between Yoren and Tyrion is pretty good.
Eating Dornish girls is the weirdest thing that Tyrion's ever personally sank his teeth into.
Yeah, I love Tyrion. Tyrion's awesome. So we go over to Dany practicing her Dothraki language skills when her servant girl grabs her boob and tells her she's pregnant. That's okay, sure.
Yep, you can tell by this.
A millimeter difference, I
sure,
guess.
Sure, sure. Her hands are finely calibrated breast inspection devices.
Yep. And I guess at that point we take it as fact. Danny's pregnant. She certainly does.
Mm-hmm.
Because
she squeezed a boob, Jim. What more do you want?
Right. And I guess like she says, "Oh, have you bled lately?" I guess
that's true.
You know, that would be a good indicator.
Yeah, yeah. And she says later on her belly, like she's starting to swell up too.
And she's having cravings. And, right. Oh man.
Right.
Yeah. So
maybe it's just too much goat meat. Did you ever think of that eerie?
Right. She just bloated from the goat meat.
Yeah. Goat bloat is leading cause of false pregnancy in all of Westeros.
Yeah, you don't get that eating dog. You just don't get it eating dog.
No.
All right, so
get the dog sog or the bog. That's where you just like feeling a lethargy, not right. The bloat. You get the bog.
So Jorah's teaching. I think it's the same Dothraki dude. Why armor is valuable? It's
the
steel dresses.
Jacaro.
Jacaro. Okay.
That could be wrong, because this guy is, I believe, an amalgamation of several different Dothraki characters from the books.
Oh, okay.
I don't think he's actually from the books, which is why it's a little bit, I'm not quite sure.
If he's in the next episode, which I want to say probably will be, I'll learn his name.
Okay.
If.
That's a luxury you get to say on Game of Thrones.
Right. So
this Ned guy, if he makes it to the next episode.
Jorah's teaching this Jakar guy why armor's valuable and how, you know, Dothraki weapons aren't really equipped to deal with it. Then there's mention of his father, who is apparently a great warrior, who we've seen. That's the other Mormont, the Gior guy.
Mm-hmm.
Up the wall.
If you didn't make the connection, that's his father. The Lord Commander of the Wall is Jorah's father.
Right. And then a servant girl comes in and announces that Dany's pregnant, and Jorah says, "I got to ride.
Mm-hmm.
I got to get out of here." He's leaving to eat something different.
Jacaro says, "I think we have a Dornish girl here." I mean,
right.
It's HBO. We take advantage of it.
So he's headed off to Quahar. I don't know how to say it, but I don't know why like this prompts him to just take off.
Right? That's suspicious
it seems
as
weird.
Fuck.
Yeah.
Like he just had this long conversation about fathers and dishonor and betrayal, and then someone comes in, "Hey, Khaleesi's pregnant, guess what?" And he's like, this long 1,000-yard stare, "I must ride to Kohor."
Gotta go.
Yeah.
What the hell, man?
Jorah.
What
are you up to, bud?
We go back up to the wall. John's teaching his brothers how to fight in the yard. You know, a little bit nicer this time.
Doing a bit more teaching, less beating.
Right, yeah. Tyrion's kind of watching it over. He goes inside where Maester Aemon says that winter is coming. He's pretty insistent about it. And insistent about the dangers of winter, even though Tyrion is, you know, notoriously doesn't believe in it.
Yeah.
And they both plead with Tyrion to get them some help once he gets back to King's Landing, because they're going to need it when the winter gets here.
Right.
And Maester Aemon, he doesn't see so well, but man, looking at him, he's pretty intense.
Right.
When he's talking about the winter and the dangers.
Yeah, so they drop a lot of science on us as far as the Night's Watch, that their strength is less than 1,000.
Right.
And there used to be a series of a ton of different castles along the wall where they would, you know, set up, be able to garrison it and constantly, you know, patrol the woods and whatnot. And at the time of Game of Thrones, it's dwindled down to just three castles being held. They've got the Shadow Tower, Eastwatch by the Sea, which is on the two extreme ends of the of the wall at both ends of the continent, and then you got Castle Black, which is the one little outpost there at King's Landing. All the other castles have fallen into ruin.
Hmm.
1,000 men holding this enormous wall doesn't sound like much.
It doesn't, nearly enough. And they basically say as much, like, we've been neglected for a very long time.
Yeah.
But winter is coming, and we are going
and
to
for
need...
real this time, not just, right. You know...
We've got reports from wherever that the temperatures are dropping, all that kind of stuff, so...
What's your read on, did this actually touch Tyrion? Because if I'm Tyrion, after making that speech about the Grumpkins and Snarks, I'm thinking, well, yeah, the old men want more men and more food and more money and more supplies because mm-hmm. their power is dwindling. This
sure.
is just... this. They're trying... And how many noble lords come to visit the wall. So this is like their one time. Like, I would be skeptical as hell at all these things they're saying.
Right.
But like you said, when Maester Aemon is like, you know, his blind ass is saying, prophesying doom, it's real enough.
You kind of believe him.
But no, I thought that there's just enough maybe doubt that Peter Dinklage played there that, like, maybe this is legit.
Yeah. Okay. Move on to Danny and Drogo laying in bed. Danny tells him the baby is a boy. I guess she had already told him that she was pregnant because it wasn't really news to him.
Right. Well, you just, the difference in left and right boob,
right.
The density, well, yeah, that right. That's it tells you every time.
Eerie. It's those Dothraki hands. It's not even the servant girls yeah. who's finely tuned. It's every Dothraki hand.
Yeah. They're born with an instinctive ability to detect.
And slaves and are brought in and they just automatically gain that ability.
Yep.
It comes with, you know, the grass. They eat the grass and that gives them the powers. Anyway, Tyrion, we go back up to the wall. He's pissing off of it before he heads out. Jon asks him to tell Bran he misses him if he visits Winterfell. And Tyrion gets a pretty good line. If you're going to be a cripple, it's better to be a rich cripple.
Hear, hear.
I agree. And then finally, Arya shows up for sword training with Syrio Forel.
He's the fucking best. God, I love this guy.
Man, he's so entertaining.
He's so good.
And he's got
such great chemistry with Arya, which, you know, early on is shaping up to be fan favorite too. The way that she's like delighting and all this kind of stuff and bristling at him calling her boy, and it's just all, and he's talking in this kind of like pseudo broken English, but it's all badass what he's saying. He's a first sword of Braavos, and he's
water
dancing.
Swords as heavy as it needs to be.
Yeah,
to make you
just so. And you know, the men are made of water, and you poke them and they leak out and they die. It's good.
It's real good.
And then Ned, so here's the other, this is the second time in two episodes that this has happened where, you know, Ned's watching her practice. Well, this is not exact thing, but then you start hearing these clanging and clashing of steel, and they're
like a battle.
Yeah,
happening.
he's got some kind of post-traumatic stress disorder going on that's brought up by you know, mentions of his former whoring ways that got him a bastard and his daughter banging wooden swords together.
Yeah, what's that all about?
What is that all about? Fuck if I know.
No clue. No clue. Anyway, yeah, super entertaining scene, and then that's the episode. So, good stuff.
FX is adapting James Clavell's best-selling novel, Shogun, into a 10-part miniseries this spring. Set in the Shogunate period of Japan at the turn of the 15th century, Shogun depicts the rise of a feudal lord to Shogun, as seen through the eyes of a shipwrecked English sailor. It's loosely based on the real-life exploits of William Adams and Tokugawa Ieyasu.
Shogun has already been successfully adapted back in 1980 with a widely acclaimed miniseries starring Richard Chamberlain. Featuring intricate plots, political scheming, complex characters, and thrilling action. This time, husband and wife team Justin Marks and Rachel Kondo try to recapture the successes of the novel and early adaptations while increasing the levels of historical and cultural accuracy that are often perceived as flaws of this and similar works.
Starring Hiroyuki Sanada from The Last Samurai, Mortal Kombat, and John Wick 4, with Cosmo Jarvis of Peaky Blinders, Raised by Wolves, etc., joining the truly massive cast required to bring this complex world to life. Join Aaron and I each week as we deep dive into each episode, uncovering the mysteries, the intrigue, and the glory of Shogun.
Shogun premieres on FX Hulu Tuesday, February 27th, with a two-part debut. Our podcast will release each Thursday thereafter. Get our Shogun coverage by searching for Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app. Hey, it's time for another season of Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? The premise is simple. A Gen Xer and a millennial watch old 80s action TV to see what still works and what doesn't. In previous seasons, we've done podcasts for Knight Rider, Airwolf, MacGyver, A-Team, and more. However, this year we're doing a very special season of Feeny. We're going back and reviewing the very special episodes of 80s and 90s sitcoms. Come cringe along with us as Hollywood tries to warn our families of the dangers of underage smoking, drug abuse, alcoholism, eating disorders, and much more. We start out with the episode of Boy Meets World where a high school kid gets sucked into a cult. Worlds collide as the Mr. Feeny finally makes an appearance on Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? Join me and my buddy Jay each week for episodes full of nostalgia and secondhand embarrassment. And don't worry, a very special isn't your speed. We've also got some all-time classic Knight Rider episodes to close the season with. Find Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? Each Wednesday on Bald Move Pulp, starting April 3rd. We're about 10 weeks out from House of the Dragon Season 2, and it's time to prepare for war.
Which in our case means, well, watching a lot of Hot D and reading a lot of Fire and Blood.
Each week between now and June 16th, Maester Anthony and his co-host Steve are hosting a watch of each episode of Hot D Season 1. And then me and Jim are going to host a discussion of the differences between the events on that episode and how they're recounted in George R. R. Martin's historical tome, Fire and Blood.
That's right, I've resorted to reading dragon books. God help us all. We'll see if my fresh eyes add any new insights or predictions into Season 2.
Arm yourselves with all the lore you can for the battles ahead. House of the Dragon returns June 16th, but we've got you covered until then.
Check out all of our upcoming Hot D coverage on the Hot D feed or on Bald Move Pulp, available wherever you listen to podcasts.
So before we get to the feedback, I want to recount a little story here. Towards the end of last season, season 6, Jim and I are sitting around like, hey, might be fun to go back and rewatch the first season.
Mm-hmm.
But then we're like, can Bald Move bear the expense? And then we're like, no problem. The listeners, trying to pun on the fly, and it's not coming together. The listeners will loan us the gold dragons we need.
Right.
And here we are, three episodes in. Are you going to pay your debts? You can sign up for Club Bald Move at club.baldmove.com for as low as one gold dragon per month.
The hosting costs are going to be like 40,000. 40,000 dragons.
Are you telling me we're 3 million gold dragons in debt?
I'm telling you we're 6 million.
Oh my God. Oh my God. But you can help us chip away by sign up for gold dragon. Conversion rate to US dollars equals one gold dragon. I thought it would be more.
Yeah.
I think it'd be more like a Benjamin.
They must be like plated.
Maybe at the start.
They're not solid gold.
Yeah. This is, before Robert took over, the dragons were worth a Benjamin, but he's really ran into the ground.
Yeah.
It's just rampant.
There's
inflation.
Just no confidence in the Bald Move economy.
You need a whole.
We're not sure it's stable.
You need a whole wheelbarrow full of dragons just to pay for a terabyte of traffic nowadays. But you can go to club.baldmove.com for as little as a buck a month. You can get a whole bunch of bonus features, ad-free feeds, so you don't have to listen to our Shakespeare in the Theater type ads anymore. You can get bonus content like our quips and our lunches and our cocktails, which I think we're going to start next week.
Yeah, got to bring that back.
Yeah, I got to bring the cocktails back. Our schedule's been conflicted. We got all kinds of different bonus stuff, VIP access to the forums. You can get the whole pitch at club.baldmove.com. If that seems like a little bit rich for your blood or a little bit too much of a commitment, I know you guys buy stuff off of Amazon. If you're there, go to amazon.baldmove.com to slide that bald move in between the Amazon and the .com. And you go to the same site, and now your shopping cart is loaded with gold dragons in advance. We get a little cut of that Amazon action. It's no surcharge to you. It's just literally giving us free money for things you're doing anyway. Please remember to use amazon.baldmove.com or sign up at club.baldmove.com because we couldn't do it. We couldn't do it without you.
What do you say we get into some feedback?
Okay, we can do that. First up, Warren R. has some good points about Kat because we both kind of agreed that she was a shit last episode. We don't like the way she treats our man John. Says she doesn't just hate John because he's a reminder of Ned's alleged infidelity. He also represents a real threat to Rob's inheritance. Let's say Ned asks his best friend Robert to legitimize John. Then John would have a real claim to Winterfell. In the books, Rob is slightly older, but only by a few months. If Rob were to die, then John would leap over Bran and Rickon. So Kat has a real reason to fear and hate John. Yeah, that's actually a good point.
It seems like a secondary concern, though. To me,
but it's probably. I mean, again, it's. I don't know. It's all these things. Yes, it's definitely a secondary concern. But if I feel like the more reasons you have to be distrustful and hate a person, the more obviously,
right, the easier it is.
Self-reinforcing it is, because if you start to soften on one, then it's like, well, you know, he could still usurp the lordship, so still got to hate him.
Yeah.
You can fall back on the other hatred.
Oh, he's a hellspawn bastard. But look how cute he is.
Right, right, right.
Oh, but it's also really, he's a threat.
And I'm really mad
inheritance.
At Ned, if I'm honest with myself. But now that I'm in this situation, he could take this, you know, yeah.
Right.
You got to have multiple avenues of hatred to keep that hate stoked strong.
Also, he's a better sword fighter than Rob. That was always the sticking point. Like, I want my real sons to be the best.
Yeah.
But here's John fucking that all up.
Yeah. Well, Sir Roderick taught all of his trueborn sons to fight left-handed as a joke.
Right.
He's the Lord's bastard. Hand. Use the left, boy. Let's see. Kate V.
Speaking of which, Arya is left-handed, yes?
Oh, I didn't notice that.
She's fighting with her left hand.
Very sinister.
Yeah.
Very sinister. Mm-hmm. Kate V said, in the King's Road, Cersei, by the way, and if I just heard anyone left, that literally the Latin for sinister is like left-handed. And dexterous is right. Like, there's some built-in.
Is that true?
Yeah, built-in cultural bias towards left people.
Man.
If you're right-handed, you're dexterous. If you're left-handed, you're sinister. So,
okay.
Don't blame me. You have to go back and fuck the Romans. Kate V, in the King's Road, Cersei goes to visit Catelyn while Bran. Jeez, I don't know why I always say Catelyn. It's Catelyn.
It sure is.
And goddamn you, George Martin, for making this even harder on a guy like me. In the King's Road episode, Cersei goes to visit Catelyn while Bran sleeps. She offers condolences in the form of a story about a child that she lost early in her marriage. Fans have often speculated about the authenticity of this story. Of course, we talked about that last week. But upon rewatch, here's what I found most interesting. Kat replies with sympathy, "Oh, I'm sorry, I never knew. I realize that Westeros does not have People magazine or social media to share the news of a royal birth, but seriously, this would be the firstborn of a new king, and a boy at that, the child of two major houses. Plus, isn't Ned Robert's best bro? He wouldn't send a single baby announcement raven to reach out for support after the baby's demise." Cersei mentions that he was taken by fever, so it's not like it was an early miscarriage or anything. Thus, I find Cersei Lannister to be a dirty liar who obviously was just sneaking upstairs to pillow poor Bran to death.
Yep.
Can you guys think of any alternative explanation for how Catelyn would not have heard about the black-haired prince taken from the world too soon?
Coma. A 10-year-long coma.
So this is a good point. If it was like a miscarriage, like at the 3 or 4 month mark, but even like if it was a miscarriage when Cersei was visibly pregnant, that would be huge news. The fact that she gave birth to a male heir that
a they had just imported a lot of goat meat. It was it was real tough to tell back in the day.
Yeah, that's the thing. She just got she got the 9 month goat belly.
She
and,
did. Goat bloat. It's real.
They cut her off the goat and went away. She had to make concoct a story.
But you're absolutely right. It seems like once a kid is born, the announcement goes out.
Especially the firstborn male prince. Of a, as she, it's not just any old king. It's the you know the rebel king. Like this is a whole new dynasty that's been formed.
Yeah,
I don't know. And you've kind of taken the series down a half peg in my estimation because that is seemingly a plot hole.
I mean, if in fact that's true, like. What he's saying is maybe Cersei's just straight up lying to Catelyn here, and Catelyn is either too naive or just ignorant to call her on it.
But here's the thing. I feel like...
Or polite.
Catelyn definitely talks this over with Ned that night, or the next time Ned comes in to check on Bran and
Did
says...
Did you know? Listen to what I learned today.
Cersei was very kind. She told me, and I had no idea. And Ned's like, what? And then he goes to Robert and says, dude, why didn't you... Like, how did literally no one in the kingdom know that your wife was pregnant and, you know, what the fuck? I get it. I'm up in Winterfell, but come on.
And then Robert goes to Cersei and is like, are you...
Right.
I had a kid and I didn't know it.
Yeah, like, you know, and you told I was punching walls? I don't punch walls. I don't... Yeah, that does makes no sense.
Yeah.
Like, I get that Cersei would lie, but it seems like she would have been found out almost instantly if people in this universe worked the way I think they do.
Well, Ned's got a lot of other stuff on his mind.
Yeah.
But you're right. I don't know why Catelyn doesn't bring it up.
Let's see. Moving on, Tom LT says, over the last several episodes, you have had some discussion on dire wolves and always seems to come down to, well, that's fantasy fiction for you. But when reading through Game of Thrones the first time, I was curious about direwolves and aurochs, which are mentioned a lot in the first two books. It turns out that both these animals are real within Earth's history. Direwolves were from 125,000 to 10,000 years ago, so they would have been around when humans started the civilization. They're not especially large wolves, approximately 150 pounds, but with bigger, sharper, and stronger teeth for taking down larger prey like mammoths and aurochs, who, by the way, were a large oxen weighing up to 3,000 pounds and standing up to 6 feet at the shoulder, and went extinct very recently, in 1627 to be precise. So they would have been around in the Middle Ages.
Hmm.
So I was familiar with this fact because I can't remember if it was the museum in Chicago or like the La Brea Tar Pits exhibit, but I did see like a mock-up of a direwolf, and I was kind of disappointed. It looks, it's certainly like its skull is heavier dutier and built, but it's not like twice as big.
Does it have
even,
long legs?
It's just kind of like a, it looks like, it's kind of like a Neanderthal version of, like Neanderthals are to Homo sapiens as the dire wolf is to the wolf.
Did you see the Grumpkin and Snark exhibit?
I did not.
It's outstanding. Like, by far the best Grumpkin Snark exhibit I've ever seen in that Chicago museum.
Mm. Yeah, yeah. Field Museum. Got all your Grumpkin and Snark needs. It's really writes in and says, how did Bran stay alive without feeding tubes while he was unconscious? That's an interesting question, and I don't know that I had to answer, except for I saw this year's Penny Dreadful, and they show how you could force feed a person, and they have this, and I looked it up, and it's a historical fact, that they had this, essentially, imagine a funnel with a giant metal tube that they just shove down a person's throat, and then they pour broth into it, and I guess that was enough to keep you going. If they could do that in the... Yeah. You know, 19th century, I see no reason why they couldn't do it in the 14th century. Because that's like, you know, none of that technology was new. Funnels, tubes.
Can I get that in the 21st century? Can I just funnel stuff into my stomach?
Yeah, you put a burrito in a blender and just pour it in.
Yeah.
Don't even have to taste it. I mean, isn't that what Soylent is?
Pretty much, yeah.
I mean, you could funnel feed yourself that for sure. So that's it for the regular old feedback edition, which you can email into. You can email. You can send in any of these emails. It doesn't have spoiler, no spoiler. GameofThrones@baldmove.com, or you can get on our forums, forums.baldmove.com. And yeah.
All right. We got a lot of spoiler emails, I guess. Yeah?
We do indeed.
Okay. Well, we're going to do all that stuff after the music. So if you're interested in hearing the spoilers, tune in then. And if not, we'll see you next week. Until then, I'm Jim.
I'm A-Rod.
And we're back with the spoiler section. What do we got?
Okay.
You want to talk about anything up front before emails?
Well, I mean, yeah. So a lot of people, because I mentioned the fact that you got these R plus L equals J truthers that still are denying the authenticity of it. And people sent in, well, the HBO infographic says that, you know, it spells it out. Lyanna and Rhaegar equals Jon.
Yeah.
But the thing is, as I know I've mentioned that on the show at least once, if not twice before, and there's just no stopping these people. So,
no.
so this is literally the last time I will post that infographic in the show notes but I think people would just come back and say, well, you know, in the actual book series it's going to be, I just feel like, you know, until I don't know what proof at this point people would accept.
I mean, to me, it's a done deal.
Yeah,
I'm
bored.
Over.
I'm bored talking about it. This is my show, and it's also your show. Do you want to talk about it more?
I just don't think there's any way that such a huge plot point is different in the books.
Yeah. So going forward, we are no longer entertaining alternative theories, and
sounds good.
I'm not answering emails. I'm just not doing
okay,
it.
Okay.
I'm
good.
Done. I'm done. It's North Dakota'd. So. Also, the thing that I really, the only thing really that stood out to me watching this episode got me excited, other than things I talked on the non-spoilers, was old Nan's talking about the winter coming. And she mentioned, because I thought this was a book-only detail, but she mentioned the legends of them hunting with their packs of pale spiders big as hounds.
Right, right.
So ice spiders is something that they mentioned. I don't think we've seen any in the books well, not certainly not in the show, but I don't even think we've seen him in the books, but they were talked about in the books. Okay. I'm like, man, I'd be fucking, because, you know, spiders are like my Waterloo. I just can't handle them. giant ice spiders sounds creepy as fuck, and I kind of hope there's pictures. Like, I know, like, I think Fantasy Flight and some of their CCG games had, there's an illustration of a knight, a white walker riding an ice spider, and it's terrifying.
I imagine, terrifying. But we've seen them riding horses, which is not nearly as scary.
They're just zombie undead horses, but not nearly as scary as... What if an ice spider is literally like an amalgamation of horse parts? Like, it's like a freakish abomination.
That'd be disgusting.
Yeah.
That'd be awesome.
It'd be kind of cool, though, too.
Yeah.
But now I'm actually on Team Ice Spider. I want to see ice spiders in Season 7.
Okay, I'm with you there.
You can just not show ghosts the rest of the series as long as I get my goddamn ice spiders.
Right.
All right. You hear me, Double D's?
In that same scene, there, you know, a crow flies in the window, or a three-eyed raven flies in the window, yeah? And the old lady is like, oh, crows are all liars. Well, now we know a lot more about where those come from.
Yeah.
And what those are doing. And I guess they're spying on Bran, or keeping tabs on him.
Yeah, there was, I can't remember which season, but after I'd read the books, I started paying attention to how often crows in particular showed up in the series,
right,
and like how much they were in the background of things. And it's kind of a cool little detail that, you know, the three-eyed raven has 1,000 eyes in one. He's like a super version of Varys, essentially.
Uh-huh.
But yeah, it's super cool. Any other insights you had, or should we?
Yeah,
get back to this?
So there's that scene where Ned and Catelyn are saying goodbye to each other.
Yeah,
this is the last time they ever see each other. Yeah,
I think you're right, because Cat goes up north,
obvious.
She runs into Tyrion, and then hilarity ensues.
Right, but I thought the cinematography here, the camera work, made it pretty obvious. Like, looking back on it, you know.
Yeah, but
hindsight.
On the other hand, dude, I was never more shocked than when Ned got killed.
Oh, right. I'm not saying, like, as a first-time viewer,
okay, okay,
you'll get that. But, like,
okay,
holy shit, it's there to be read into if you are a second-time viewer.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because they just push in on their faces, these thousand, like, long, lingering looks at each other. It's really something.
Huh.
And then I couldn't help but notice how... These Starks, man, they love to leave people hanging.
Mm.
Benjen, up at the wall, we'll talk about it next time we speak. Fuck you, Benjen. Fuck you, Ned.
Six seasons later, yeah.
Right. And they still haven't spoken about it. It's like,
right,
these guys love, like, they love to leave you hanging.
Sure.
Love
That's
it.
The Starks' lesser-known motto. We love to leave you hanging. We'll talk about it when I return. That's winter is coming. We'll speak of it when I return.
Right. And Jorah is essentially doing the same thing here. Like, okay, so is this part of his spying operation?
Yeah.
On Dany? Is that why he's going to Quahog or whatever it is?
You literally will see, I think, in the next episode or episode after that, them reading some letter about her got, you know,
really?
this cow's got her with child and Robert wants to kill her. And
gotcha.
Ned's all pissed off about it. So, yeah, that's the thing. Like, I felt like, I can't remember my initial reaction, but I felt like it was really heavy-handed.
Yeah.
They're like, oh, she's pregnant? I must ride.
It was. I mean, even...
Because they haven't...
You know, not being sure.
They haven't really started the romance angle yet.
No.
That comes, like, I haven't gotten a whiff, and I've been looking for it. Like, okay, when did he start catching feelings for Khaleesi?
Mm-hmm.
Which is hilarious, because, like, I remember for, like, the first three seasons, the casual fan, she didn't have a name. She's just Khaleesi. You know, Daenerys.
What do you mean? She didn't have a name.
I'm just saying everyone called her Khaleesi. That was like, you know, that was her Sean Bean name.
Okay.
I don't know her name. It's Khaleesi.
Gotcha.
And Khaleesi's dumbass brother. But yeah, I think because when I was watching this, I'm like, oh God, this is so. And I rewound it and watched it. I'm like, wait, maybe there's another ex. Maybe it's like we're supposed to realize that he's upset because he's really in love with her and now he's pregnant. But like, no, I don't think so.
Yeah, no, it seems pretty obvious in retrospect.
Yeah, yeah.
That's all I got.
Okay, anyway, Brian J. said, on the last podcast, you were talking about how Jorah's home was a real shithole, especially when compared to Winterfell, which is also apparently run down in the show. Mm-hmm. However, I'd remind you guys that we saw Bear Island in the latest season, and if you remember correctly, it was far from a shithole in the show. Jorah, as the Lord of Bear Island before his banishment, would have lived in that awesome castle. Not really important, and obviously wealth is all relative when comparing northern and southern wealth, but it's strange to hear Jorah describe himself as poor and forced into selling slaves. So, I actually mentioned this in the spoiler section, but in the book, the Mormon house is a shithole. It's essentially like one of those wooden log stockades on a muddy hill.
Okay. So they it's not bad in the show.
I remember when I saw it, I'm like, well, this is a perfectly respectable castle. What the fuck? It was kind of a shock to me. So I don't. And it's funny because the Double D's know that about the Mormons because they use it in their story. And yet then when we see the castle, it's perfectly nice looking. Like
I don't remember it. Is it like a smaller castle? Is it?
I mean, it's smaller than Winterfell, but there's no fallen down castle walls and broken shit to it either. No, I actually thought they fucked up that in all of the northern keeps that they showed. Like, they all were way too fancy and nice for what I think they would actually have. Like, maybe maybe the Manderleys would have a pretty, because they're like the wealthiest house in Westeros because they have the sea harbor and they've gotten done a lot of trade. And, that you know, plus they came from the south, so I think they had a little bit of wealth to start with. But, like, yeah, I was really expecting more. And, again, not hovels. Like, I'm not saying, when I say shithole, I mean, you know, like dirt floors. But probably it's probably warm and snug and safe and secure and, like, better than some, like, you know, crofter's keep or whatever. But still, it's described as, like, a wood palisade kind of, you know, like what like
The village people live in.
The village people, I was trying to say, like, Pocahontas. Remember the Disney movie Pocahontas?
Sure. I never saw it.
Really?
No, never saw Pocahontas. I know what it is, but I don't know what you're talking about.
And I don't either. I'm talking about Pocahontas, but...
Okay.
Yeah, so I don't... That is a kind of irreconcilable... Now, if we wanted to try to reconcile this difference, would it be that Mormon's wife was used to the far more lavish southern, because it's not just the fact that his home was a shithole, but also there's just no culture. Like, there, you know, people didn't go to Bear Island with troops of mummers to put on shows.
Right,
they didn't have tournaments where the ladies would turn out in their finest garb and you'd have chefs. It's all like, it's kind of like you can have a super nice house in Mooresville, Indiana. Guess what? You're still not going to impress anybody from LA or New York. There's a little bit of that regional, you know, prejudice as well.
Okay, right.
So yeah, that's the best way I can kind of square that round peg. Josh F. says, I don't buy the idea that Ned would realistically think he had any reason to fear telling Catelyn about Jon's parentage. Ned's promise to Lyanna, as we found out in the show, was to protect Jon and not specifically to keep the secret to himself. All Lyanna asks of Ned is to protect her son from Robert, as we also hear her say that in a scene. So we can't really say that his decision not to tell Catelyn was based on him being sworn to secrecy from telling anyone. Which...
I can't say that it's not either. Like,
I get the jet... So, Josh, my first reaction to this email is like, well, Josh, you're arguing with what's actually happening on the show. Like, you can say that Ned's dumb for doing that, but it's a canon fact that he didn't tell his wife.
That is, in fact, the decision he made. So,
I think he's coming from more of like, is this poor writing, as he continues.
Okay.
Which brings us to the idea that he would be putting Jon or Jon's secret in danger by telling Catelyn. As a lady of House Stark, with Stark children as heirs to Winterfell, Catelyn is just as much invested in the well-being of House Stark and just as much reason to keep the secret between them as Ned did.
Really? Because we just heard a guy lay out a pretty good case for why Jon might anger Catelyn so much about the inheritance.
If Ned told him the truth, she would then know that he is no threat because he's not in the line. He is not anywhere in the line to inherit Winterfell. Certainly not. I mean, he would be, but Ned's male children would have to die before Jon would step in.
Gotcha.
And at that point, can you even be mad?
Sure. Like, then you're just glad you got something.
Sure. Something warm to put on the throne.
Yeah.
Ned realized, just as Catelyn would have, that their entire family would have been in big trouble if Robert had found out about Ned lying to him all these years to protect Lyanna's Targaryen bastard son. At best, the Starks would have had Winterfell taken from them and given over to another great northern house. At worst, he would have started a bloody war between the north and south. And we know how that turns out in this country. Pretty well. The slaves get free. and the Union is saved. Maybe they should have had a war between the North and South.
Yeah.
Also, you would have to keep in mind that John would have been Catelyn Stark's family had she found out that she was his aunt. Family, duty, honor are the words she grew up with as a Tully, and it shows in her character. One caveat would be that I could understand if he kept a secret from Catelyn for the first year or so while he didn't know her very well. Ned didn't have time to court her before marrying her and knocking her up when the war started, so perhaps he may not have known how much he could trust her initially, which makes sense. Mm-hmm. However, after she popped out his first child and she... I love this... got a better measure of her from living with her, he would have seen how devoted she was to the family. And even if she wasn't devoted again, she's personally invested in no one finding out. I mean, all this stuff is true. But at the end of the day, Ned still, like...
Yeah, and at the end of the day, the only way you can be 100% sure that your secret will be kept is to tell no one.
Exactly.
And like, that's exactly thing, what Ned did.
I'm not even really sure that Benjen knows. Like...
Sure, no, we've speculated, like, does he know?
Well, right.
He might, but he might not.
Yeah, like, I feel like that Ned took this super serious.
Here's the other thing. What does Howlin actually know? Are we 100% sure that he knows? Because he doesn't go up to that tower.
But he does survive. So that's, okay, you bring up a good point. He does survive the fight. He right. would have seen Ned bring down a child yep. out of the tower.
Right.
That Lyanna was in, screaming. Like, I don't know.
Sure. I'm just throwing it out there.
I'm the big
I'm not...
proponent of put the hand on the hilt of the sword and, like, don't ask me any questions, Howlin. But, like, I think right. that's stretching it a bit.
Okay. Fair enough. But I don't know that he wants anyone to know. That would be my thing. Like,
yeah, I think in the perfect world, Ned would have zero other people than him know the secret.
Yeah. Howland's already a loose end. I don't know that he wants another loose end in Catelyn, regardless of how loyal he thinks she is.
Right.
And that's apparently how he feels about it, because he never
told
her.
I think Ned trusts her with his life. I don't think he trusts her with the life of someone else that's been put in his charge.
Hmm.
So, I mean, that's the thing. Like, is that against Ned's character? I don't see it as against his character. I see that as him just not wanting to do anything to risk the promise to his dead sister.
Right. That's how I feel about it.
But
too.
I do think in the analysis, if he had brought Kat in, and I right. agree everything else, like, yes, she was betrothed to Brandon. He didn't know that she's going to be a stand-up woman. He comes back and maybe a year or two. It's like, but then also he sees how he reacts to this bastard thing.
Yeah.
Maybe that's a little bit of initial rift.
I get what you're saying, and I think you're right. It's not like, I think with perfect hindsight, we know that Catelyn is loyal to Ned until the very end. They never get super angry at each other. They never actually like would have reason to divulge secrets like that.
And his point about
but
the Tullys,
he couldn't have known that. And if he made this promise to his sister, I feel like he might have made the right choice not to tell anyone.
And I like his point about the Tullys, that their words are family, duty, honor, and the order of which those come is presumably carefully selected.
Yeah.
So I 100% agree with her analysis, but canonically, Ned didn't do it, and I think it's more, for wherever possible, I try to find ways where that the canon facts do fit the characterizations and not where they don't. So I find it entirely plausible that Ned would, like we said, in a perfect world, no one would know but him. In this imperfect world, him and Howlin know.
Yeah.
So and now that I said that, I'm kind of convinced that he didn't tell Benjen. Because if he told...
Yeah, it would be insane not to tell Catelyn after you've told Benjen.
Right. I know the Benjen is like blood at this point, but, you know, at some point I think that Ned would feel at least as close to his wife as he does to his brother, who's up at the wall and he never sees.
Yeah.
Anyway, good email, though. Nancy S. says, I wanted to follow up on the discussion y'all had about Cersei's visit to Bran's sick room and whether she may have designs on finishing off then and there. I never read the scene that way before, and I disagree with the interpretation. I think it was pretty widely known that around the castle, that Kat never left Bran's side, so I don't think Cersei could have expected to have the opportunity to do anything when she visited. Anne had the opportunity to present itself while she was there. I don't imagine she could have taken it without casting a lot of suspicion on herself, which even the Queen of Poor Choices would recognize as a bad idea. Cersei, that would be hilarious if that's her official, how she becomes known, like, you know, Olenna's the Queen of Thorns. She's the Queen of Poor Choices. Cersei's visit may have had a few purposes, including, one, to see for herself the state of Bran's health and likelihood of recovery. Two, sure. to keep up appearances that she is concerned about Bran and his family, and or because of it's the polite expected thing to do. Three, to further defray suspicion from herself by convincing Kat that she can appreciate the difficulty of her situation. And four, maybe the case to joint for a possible future attempt on Bran's life, either directly or more likely through an agent. So yeah, that...
Sure.
I think four is as good as saying she was there to kill him herself. She was there to case the joint.
Okay. Right. You know, so not there to do the deed yet.
Check out the laser grid security and look at the guard rotations. And,
right.
You know.
Make sure that, you know, Ed Norton's going to be out of the house for a while.
Exactly. Exactly. Measure the suspension travel of the trucks going in and out.
Right.
You know, the unloading the tons of beef broth that they're just forcing down Bran's throat with a funnel.
Woke up 60 pounds heavier. It was amazing.
He actually wasn't paralyzed. He's just too fat to move. Kelsey W. said, I want to send a quick reminder about Cersei's backstory that you seem to have forgotten.
Oh, boy.
An accusation filed at me. In the spoiler section of episode 1 and 2, you mentioned that you do not buy Cersei's story about giving birth to Robert's black-haired son and being really upset when this infant dies. You say that she hated Robert. While this is certainly true that she hates Robert now, and evil or not, he definitely deserves her hatred. She did not hate him when they married. In fact, she was getting everything that she wanted. She became queen, and Robert was once very handsome and gallant. She wanted to love him and be happy with him, and even though she wasn't the nicest person even then, with the treatment of Tyrion, etc., she was much more innocent than she was now. Her love of Robert soured after she realized that he would never love her because of Lyanna, and that he cheated on her constantly and was not there for her when she gave birth to their first and only son, or after the child died. Remember that even if Cersei hated Robert from the beginning, which she didn't, her children were always the most important thing to her, and a child fathered by Robert would have been no different. This realization that Robert would never truly love her or their children through no fault of her own is part of the reason why Cersei has become so hardened in the first place. So, what do you think, Jim?
I'm not certain what point is trying to be made here.
That we said was one evidence that this story with Cersei's child was bullshit is that she hated Robert from the beginning.
Okay.
But, and that's the thing, like, I couldn't remember, I know in the books that that wasn't true. That Cersei, okay. And that's the thing about the tragedy of Cersei and Jaime's relationship is Cersei's never been that into Jaime. Like, she definitely has loved him, but, like, she was all about marrying Rhaegar. She was all about marrying Robert until Robert stumbled into her room drunk and was saying, oh, Lyanna, as he fucked her for the first time.
Yeah, that'll do it.
And also, I think I believe that she actually... There's a line, because you get a lot of Cersei POV in the later books, and there's a line where she used to go to Maester Pycelle every single time that Robert got with her to get the Westerosi Mortificant.
Yeah, yeah.
It's Moon Tea is what they called it.
Okay.
And also there's a lot of like really graphic details where Cersei would do whatever she could to finish him on the outside. There's this one particular line where she's talking about licking how all the air's off of her fingers and
that. Oh yeah, that must be a great read.
Yeah, huh? Yeah.
With Martin's flowery sexual dialogue.
Sure.
Okay, so fair, I guess. Like, you know, we didn't consider that maybe at one point she had loved Robert.
But I still think the story about the child is bullshit.
Right.
For all the other reasons
we've propped it up with another pillar here.
Yeah, yeah.
So it still stands.
Someone will probably knock it down next week with another book fact that I've forgotten. But yeah, and that's like Jaime has only ever loved Cersei, but I don't think you could say the same for Cersei.
Okay, fair.
T. Hunter from Germany says, I was thinking about Bran's future a lot, and I gotta ask myself why everyone thinks the mark on Bran's arm is such a huge problem for their journey back south of the Wall. I mean, it's not like Bran's arms have much use left. Why not just amputate the damn thing or burn out the mark or something along those lines?
Make him a quadriplegic?
This is the quintessential German solution to the problem.
Okay.
The efficiency of the solution.
Right.
The finality of it, even.
Okay, so hack off both of his other limbs, because
right?
He's got one bad one.
Right, or just burn it out. Why not?
what do you mean his arms aren't of that much use anymore?
He's not a quadriplegic. He's
not
a paraplegic.
Yet. You He'll would be have a him be
uniplegic. Or wait, no.
No, it'd be a triplegic. Yeah.
I
can't get past his arms are of no use anymore.
Well, here's the thing. Like, he continues.
Okay.
And since they know the White Walkers will hunt the Mark and know where it is, they could even keep the amputated body part to later set up some huge trap.
Oh, my God.
Like, I could just see the White Walker. It's kind of like that scene from Lord of the Rings where the ring wraiths are stabbing the empty pillows, and they right. they fling it back, and there's just a bloody arm there, and they all start screaming.
There's a look of realization on the White Walker's
face. We've been had!
And then here comes a triplegic Bran on the back of... what's her name?
Mira?
Mira, yeah.
I thought
yeah.
you were going to go dragon, but yeah, sure.
Coming at him with
riding,
a spear.
Yeah. Mira in the battle with a sword between his teeth.
Right. His one good arm waving in the wind.
He could choose whatever they do. I definitely think the Mark can be used for their advantage in the end.
Oh, man. But that's Bravo. Only if they understand it. Right?
Yes.
So that's only if they understand that it could be a threat.
And also,
like
is the other thing is there's a lot of assumptions of facts, magical facts, not in evidence. For example, the Mark is like this physical thing. Like, I guess, like, why can't it be like the physical manifestation of a psychic brand?
Right.
So, like, he's just
Well, his
marked.
Head's useless, too. Everything's useless right. on him now that he
yeah.
has no legs.
Well, I mean, he could just warg into a, you know, warg into a tree and just cast off his body.
I mean, if you want to start chopping limbs off, chop the legs off. At least make him lighter.
Mm.
Like,
well, that's
if I
what
were
I'm saying.
Hodor,
like, if I was going
I'd
to amputate
first.
His arm, I would go with arm and legs, because then Mira could, you know, tuck
yeah.
him around.
Yeah.
Tuck him around. Carry him. Lug him. I meant to say lug.
Just tuck him under an arm.
My brain said lug, my mouth said tuck, and that's my life.
Okay.
So, yeah, I think Bran might disagree with your survey of his utility there, Hunter, but
I mean, in what world do you lose the use of your legs and suddenly your arms are also useless?
They're basically useless.
Okay.
I mean, you could do needlepoint, but
I don't know if I buy that reasoning, but okay.
He needs at least one hand so he can touch a tree root.
Right.
Unless
right.
he can just do like that would be a funny visual. He just like puts his mouth on it,
mm-hmm.
starts gumming a tree. Okay. Let's
They've
move
taken
on.
His teeth out now too? Is that
well,
what I'm hearing?
I mean, they're basically useless. You got the funnel. You just keep putting the... you just keep shoving the broth down his belly. Why does
Fair
he
enough.
Need teeth? This is going to be some kind of fucking Metallica nightmare before this story's over. Susan S. said, in your most recent episode, there's some discussion about the requirements for the position of Hand of the King. I am basing my information off the books, including the World of Ice and Fire of the Westeros.org wiki.
All right. Let's hear it.
While I'm sure they'd be unwise to outright refuse the position of the Hand, as Catelyn and Ned discussed after Robert's offer, Hands can and do resign from office, and the King can replace the Hand at any time.
Bran's hands have resigned from office.
So this I've actually had to cut down, because this is a very long and scholarly email. But she gives some examples during the reign of Aerys II, the Mad King, the second, rather, that are that Tywin did try to resign after Aerys had publicly insulted his wife, Joanna. And, you know, people differ and know what exactly the insult was. But Aerys refused to accept the resignation, probably similar to how Robert refused to accept Ned's resignation after he cooled down over the Daenerys execution issue. However, after Aerys made Jaime Lannister a member of the Kingsguard, Aerys accepted Tywin's resignation. The animosity between the two men, as well as Aerys' paranoia about Tywin, had reached the point that both men were happy to end the relationship. Aerys then replaced Tywin with Owen Merryweather, an elderly courtier, who was agreeable with everything Aerys wanted. But he proved ineffectual with the needs of the realm once Robert's rebellion was underway. Aerys' paranoia led him to believe that Merryweather was conspiring with the rebels, so Merryweather, too, was stripped of the office, his lands and titles, and sent into exile. This is when Aerys appointed John Connington, one of Prince Rhaegar's closest companions, to the position of Hand. The king thought the younger man might be what was needed at the time, but after losing battles, Connington was also stripped of his lands, titles, and exiles, which, if you've been paying attention to the spoiler edition, John Connington is the guy who is raising what is claimed to be Aegon Targaryen in exile over in Essos.
And
he then leads them back after a lot of trials and tribulations, and they land in Westeros at the end of the book 5. But I I and many others think that he's a fake Targaryen and this is some kind of scam. The next hand that served on a small council as the Master of Coins before Aerys appointed him to the position of hand. Carlton Chestald had an unluckier fate than his predecessors. Once Aerys decided his council was poor, he had Chestald burned alive, which led to Aerys' final hand, the alchemist Rosart. I think you already know the fate of this man. He actually served as hand for only 2 weeks, made him a bunch of wildfire. He's also the one of the ones that was instrumental in like burning Ned's father to death, but Jaime killed him right as he was trying to run out the room to set fire to King's Landing. And she mentions a whole other, like, more benign examples of hands resigning and being an exiled and whatnot, including Brendan Rivers, who ended up becoming the Blood Raven, who is the Three-Eyed Crow.
Huh.
There's no evidence of that, in fact, in the show, but in the books, he's actually a really old former hand of the king that had to take the black over some shenanigans.
So not like taking the black. You can resign as long as, you know, the king will let you.
Yeah. That's the thing. It's definitely at the pleasure of the king. I don't know. Right. And like you said, we've seen an example in the show later on where Robert refuses to accept the resignation. So I guess that's a thing. Yeah. I mean, it'd be interesting to see, like, what would happen if a hand just pushed the point. I mean, I guess it's any other thing where you're rebelling against the king.
Yeah.
It's your personal relationship with them that's going to save you at that point, not, like, some kind of law. All right, Rachel H., some comments about the dagger. We asserted some facts last week in the spoiler section. She points out it never actually belonged to Tyrion. As both Jaime and Tyrion independently pointed out, Tyrion would never bet against Jaime, which is something, actually, damn it, that's a point I meant to mention in the main show, that I was, in the non-spoiler section, I thought it was interesting that in the previous episode, they kind of questioned Tyrion's loyalty to the family, and then we hear that he bet against his brother in a tournament, and it's like things were stacking up against Tyrion in the show. Anyway, however, Robert Wood, King Robert Wood, and Jaime remembered him showing off the dagger at the tournament feast. Jaime and Tyrion also independently arrived at the conclusion that Joffrey arranged the assassination for the reason Aeron had proposed, parental approval with the added bonus of cruelty. The show had the opportunity to include Book Joffrey's boast about being familiar with Valyrian steel when Tywin gifts him Widow's Wail in Season 4, but the Double D's probably correctly assumed that the readers would not remember that Season 1 dangling thread. And indeed, I don't think anybody is really bothered about the mystery of who killed Bran.
Who tried to kill Bran.
And it's not even really dealt with in the books. Like, it's something that probably with a stronger editor would have been kind of removed because it's people's ruminations over who they think did it, so...
Right. Okay.
I think Littlefinger, it's one of the reasons the later books are the size of phone books. I think Littlefinger pointed to Kat and Tyrion's direction because Littlefinger is trying to foment discord between the Starks and Lannisters. Tyrion's by far the easiest Lannister target. It's a huge risk, but Littlefinger was gambling on Kat's trust in him and her mama bearness slash hotheadedness, because if she talked to Ned about it first and they brought it up at the court, Robert would have claimed it, and Kat would not have kidnapped Tyrion and sparked the war, etc.
Okay. What about the idea that maybe Littlefinger is trying to claim Kat for himself? Getting that out of the picture.
So, that's something I did want to talk to you about. At what point did he start having designs on Sansa?
Not yet.
At the Red Wedding?
I feel like there was that tournament thing where he's, like, talking to her. But isn't there, like, a jousting event or something later on?
It's at this hand, tournament to hand where he meets her.
Okay.
You think he's starting to lust after her at that point?
Maybe. Like, the very beginning.
I'm definitely going to be looking for evidence of that when I'm watching this. Because he essentially claims in the current season, season 6, that it's been his plan from all along. And now I don't know what that definition of all along is to have him being on the Iron Throne with Sansa at his side.
Right.
And because at this point, for what I know of Littlefinger, is that he feels spurned by Kat, and I don't think he would want her at this point.
Oh, okay.
That he's switched his fixation to Sansa. I don't know at this point. But when I say at this point, I don't think he wants Catelyn back, and he realizes that there's no universe in which that she would take him back. In fact,
she mentions
says,
that he's the little brother. Yeah,
yeah, that's not something you say about someone that gets you all moist and hot and bothered.
No.
So I think he's smart enough to know that.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I mean, it's still fair to say that he carries a torch for her and loves her and all that, but I don't think he can get over his rejection and humiliation.
Okay.
Anyway, let's see. Eliza Von O said, wanted to weigh in on the theory that Tyrion poses a threat to Dany's future reign in Westeros, and she may even have to sacrifice his life to hold power. This rustled a lot of Jimmys on last week's show.
She'd have to sacrifice whose life?
Remember that one of the emailers had a theory that Tyrion was going to get sacrificed by Dany because he's such a pariah in Westeros.
Right.
And either he'll command it himself, like, look, you got to cut me loose.
Or she'll interpret it to
or she'll
read,
remember
she'll read it that way.
Yeah, right? And, like, and that's the thing, like, I don't know that cut loose means kill. Like, she could exile him.
Right.
He could take the black. That'd be fun.
Yeah.
But but anyway, it got a lot of people upset. Eliza says, I think I'm not buying it, though. I think although Tyrion is viewed negatively as a public figure, I think a persistent theme in both The Song of Ice and Fire and the TV show is that small folk want food, shelter, and safety. At the end of the day, they care nothing for the games of kings and lords. Westeros, on TV at least, is headed for some serious bad times under the rule of Queen Cersei. There's every reason to believe Olenna Tyrell will cut off food supply from the Reach. Cersei has repeatedly demonstrated absolute indifference to the suffering of small folk, and you can be sure she will be doing nothing to feed her starving subjects, even if it were possible to do so. Any uprisings or even murmured dissent from her subjects will be met with swift, brutal, and horrific violence. All the tracks have been laid. When Daenerys finally marches on King's Landing with a royal lineage, massive naval fleet, tens of thousands of soldiers, and three dragons, who are thought in Westeros to be extinct, to free them from Queen Cersei the Terrible, I have no doubt they will see her as their savior and welcome her with open arms. Dany will smash Cersei. It's only a question of when it will go down and how much damage Cersei will do in the meantime. Really, the only people who hate Tyrion with any passion are his siblings, mostly Cersei. Once the Lannisters are finally disposed of, I don't think the people will really give a shit who Daenerys chooses to advise her or to sit at her small council. Also, between recovering from the inevitable battle between Dany and Cersei and the fallout of Cersei's reign, coupled with the imminence of the War of the Dawn, I don't think anyone will have a lot of time or energy for political navel gazing in King's Landing. Also, for all our other flaws, Dany is not one to compromise her deeply held beliefs and values under political pressure. She's the last person who would throw someone she loves and values under the bus for political expediency. I do have a very strong disagreement with that last line, because she just fucking did it with Dario.
She said she felt nothing. So, I mean, I guess you could argue that maybe she doesn't love Dario. Maybe there's nothing there.
Well, she said she felt nothing about his dismissal, not...
Right.
And
that's what I mean, like... I don't know. I guess I mostly agree with you there.
Yeah, no, and I agree that that's a certain way to look at it. Like, I took it as, like, her saying that, you know, you could interpret that as she feels numb, or maybe she's in, like, a different stage of grief, but she also acknowledged the fact that he loved her and that she loved him at some point. Maybe that's the part that I'm imagining.
Well, so, okay, a lot of this is based on... So I don't necessarily disagree with a lot of this email. I think, you know, the next logical step for Olenna is, like she said, cut off the food supply, going to cause serious problems in King's Landing. It's already broke.
That's a season two plot. Like, right. You know, the
that's the whole reason they're joining these houses in the first place.
Right.
Is money and food and, like, just the prosperity of the kingdom.
Yeah.
Without the... Tyrells?
Mm-hmm.
Tyrells?
Yeah, Tyrell.
Okay. They have big problems. So the only problem I have with saying that all this stuff is going to go down with shortage of food supply and they're going to hate Cersei by the end is Dany's on her way. Mm-hmm. And that narrow sea is narrow.
Mm-hmm.
Like a day is what you said
days
to cross it?
Well, I mean, she's much further east along the continent. So
she's got to sell.
No more than a week or two.
That's the thing. Like, depending on how these timelines are lining up, mm-hmm. like, I don't know if it's going to be months from when Cersei blows up the temple to when Dany arrives. Then I could see it. But if it's only a week, I don't think that people are going to have time to hate Cersei that much.
Right.
Now, she did kill
a shit ton
you know,
of people,
Marjorie,
and
who the people love.
And burnt down the most important religious site
right.
in all of Westeros.
So this is where I do start to agree a little more, is that people probably don't like her already.
Yeah.
But we know for a fact that people do dislike Tyrion in the land. He's seen as the cause of a lot of problems.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I mean, I guess if you it comes down to whether or not you think the people care about who is leading them.
Yeah.
Or do they just care about the food in their belly?
And also, to some extent, how Martin wants to handle it, because there's also precedent for this, right? Lord Tywin came to King's Landing, sacked it, and had his henchmen rape the princess of a beloved prince. Like, everyone loved Rhaegar Targaryen. He was like the people's champ, you know. Everyone hated his father, but they all thought, oh man, as soon as he takes over, we'll be good. And everyone loved the princess and thought their children adorable. This guy came in and raped the princess and bashed the brains of the babies with his bare hands. Yet Tywin came out looking, you know, smelling like a rose because, you know, Robert pardoned everybody and rewarded them for their service, and people kind of got over it.
And I think she's
right that if Dany can bring peace and prosperity, that everything else is secondary.
Sure.
But
I think it's going to take some time for them to accept it, though, because, like...
Well, here's the thing. Let's say that Dany takes over King's Landing. This isn't going to be an epic battle. She just bowls it over.
Right.
What happens next? Winter's coming.
Right.
That's the worst thing that can happen yet, and that's where she's going to have problems, because the small folk are going to be like, well, of course the White Walkers are come down because you put some demon imp on the throne, and this is the God's vengeance for all the things.
Okay.
That's, I think, where maybe it and Tyrion's like, look, you need a political win, you know, or, like I said, I think it'd be more poignant if Tyrion is the one that puts his neck in the noose, but Dany in a fit of real politic could do that. I don't know.
Yeah, I just think it's weird that if, like, you keep mentioning, oh, the people love this king, or the people love this princess, or the people hate this king. It would be weird to me that all of these things are mentioned in the books and the show, and then that's not a factor. Like, the people aren't a factor at all.
Yeah, sure.
Like, the how much the people like the ruler. Because that's essentially what the emailer is saying, is they don't care about who rules them.
Right.
Which I don't know if I totally buy, especially given the context of, oh, the people love this king or this queen.
Yeah.
So, I don't know. It's certainly possible that, you know, I'm not sold on Tyrion. I don't want Tyrion to die.
I don't either.
I want him to live.
But I think it's an interesting storytelling possibility.
Right.
That they've kind of laid tracks with, you know, like...
This started to.
Like, this is Chekhov's, what would you call it? Political gambit.
Chekhov's advice.
Like no one really liked Dario. No one really wanted to see Dany shack up with him. So they're introducing, you have to do painful things and make sacrifices for the greater political good. Why introduce that mechanic if not to have a greater fulfillment later on down the line?
Does Chekhov's whatever even apply when there are no acts? When it's this long, ongoing...
Who knows?
...thing.
It's Chekhov's trope is its own thing at this point.
I suppose so.
Okay, moving on to Megan M. One of the things I noticed was Peter Baelish's voice changed a lot since season one.
Yeah.
Season one, he sounds like a normal human being. By season six, he's almost approaching the Dark Knight with this weird effect. Am I the only one who notices this?
No, you're right. You're totally right.
The whole there's something insubstantial about this version, like weedy, or reedy about this guy.
I think the actor himself had not figured out the character quite yet. I think he was growing into it.
Yeah.
Because he sounds a lot more like the actor, honestly, in these early scenes.
Yeah, and he has not much power. Like he's risen to the master of coin at this point.
Yeah.
Like, by the time in season six, he owns Harrenhal, he owns the Vale, and he's got some real weight behind him.
Yeah.
So I feel like that he lets his evil freak flag fly a little bit more freely. That's a lot of alliteration I just dropped on people. Because he's got the power to back it up.
Sure.
Makes sense. He's definitely a lot growlier and dropped an octave or so.
Yep.
That's the other thing. It turns out his balls dropped. It's a very late adolescent for Littlefinger. Another reason... No. Well, everybody else make the connection. Anthony, in season one, episode three, the one we're discussing, we are introduced to two new recruits of the Night's Watch, Grin and Pip. Given that this is a modern fantasy narrative that Gurm likes to nod to popular narratives from time to time, these names seem to echo Frodo's traveling companions in Lord of the Rings, mm-hmm. Peregrin and Pippin. All we need now is a portly but super loyal companion named Sam, and I think we might think that Jon Snow is a Frodo type. Could this be Gurm's way of pointing out to Jon's narrative, or how Jon's narrative will unfold? Perhaps he will wield a great and ancient power beyond his understanding, struggle with his own dark side, experience a death or resurrection of sorts, and ultimately save the realm from an evil overlord? Or is Gurm just tipping his cap to Tolkien?
That was my first instinct.
Yeah.
Is just, you know, he has talked, obviously, about where the origins of this story come from. And that's part of it, so why not?
Well, it's interesting, because Pippin and Grin are, that's a reference to the same character, Peregrin Took. Whose short name is Pip. So that's weird.
Oh, is it?
Frodo's other companion is Merry. There is no character named Merry that Jon hangs around with, but the opposite of Merry, Dolorous? And we've got Dolorous Ed? Or Dolorous?
Why is that the opposite of Merry?
Well, Dolorous means like kind of dour and grumpy and sad and down in the mat, and Merry is like Merry, be merry.
Okay. All right.
It's just a really bad Tolkien joke, but I couldn't let slide the assertion that Pip and Grin are two separate, you know. It's like, no, right. it's Pip and Merry. So.
Okay. I didn't know that.
Yeah. As I hike my glasses up on my nose. Kimberly G said, let's talk about this a bit. I don't think I think it's just a tip of the cap, because right. I don't think that this theory has any predictive power, nor do I think that Anthony is actually suggesting that. But, like, I don't know, it'd be an interesting idea if, you know, it's like John has to go north to destroy some artifact.
Okay.
I can't imagine, like, because, like, we talked about the Horn of Joramund, the horn that you could blow and bring down the wall. And that seems to be, even in the book, something that was just a gambit or a made-up thing. We do have the dragon horn that Euron supposedly has that is completely absent in the TV series. That could be something else that would be a threat to the quote-unquote good guys. I don't know. He has to go to the largest obsidian mountain, and they don't have like a one ring. So
yeah.
But like I said, I grant it doesn't have much predictive power. I don't even know why I'm entertaining this.
Okay.
Moving on, Kimberly G. Did you notice how Ned told Arya to stand by Sansa because they have too many enemies now and they can't fight family? Exactly like Jon told Sansa that they have to trust each other because they have too many enemies in season 6. One of the many parallels between seasons 1 and 6.
Yeah.
I think the writers are absolutely brilliant. Yeah, I didn't actually catch that, but you're right. It's funny, though, that John and says it to Sansa when it's you'd think it'd be something that Arya would say to one of the two to echo what her father said, and like the wisdom that she got.
But, well, she's not around.
And also, if they showed many parallels between John and Ned, like him telling the brother to keep his shield up, and something that we find out Ned told to his little brother. Moving on, Jordan from England said, I do find it strange that Ned and Kat are so willing to trust Peter Baelish. Ned to a lesser extent, but certainly Kat would be aware of his devious ways. There must have been some hints that he was untrustworthy and jealous when they were growing up together in River Run. Perhaps she's just overcome with what's happened to her son, and perhaps they're both just naive. Either way, it feels a bit strange, especially after what we see in later seasons, that we put a lot of faith in, they put a lot of faith in their quote-unquote friend Peter Baelish. Is this an oversight from a writing perspective, or is it just a character trait?
So, I understand why Ned goes for it, because Kat's going for it.
Yeah.
And he implicitly trusts Kat. What is it about the background between Littlefinger and Catelyn that makes Catelyn trust him so much? Do you know?
Just that they grew up together. So,
okay.
In the exact same way that Ned and Robert were, like, squired or warded by Jon Arryn, the Tullys warded Littlefinger, like, took him in and, like, you know, we're going to teach you to be a man.
Gotcha.
So, like, And I guess that, like, Kat and Liza used to, like, you know, play kissing games with him, you know, play doctor and who knows what all else. But
okay.
And that Liza genuinely had the hots for Peter, but Kat never did. And it's a love triangle. Littlefinger had the hots for Kat,
right,
who never returned it. To the extent that he challenged, you know, Brendan, her and betrothed, to a duel for her honor. So that's the thing. Like, even I guess were there any signs that Littlefinger was the devious little shit that he ends up being in when he was a child? And probably a little bit, but also how much of this being spurned and rejected because he wasn't highborn or as highborn was a formative event for him, and like how much of that ambition to like I need to have it all is an effort to fill this hole that was left by Kat not loving him. I don't know. And also, like, I've ran into like people and I knew in high school and they've like completely changed as adults, or they're, you know, you assume they've changed and you're like, oh no, this is the same kind of immature asshole, they've never really grown up,
right?
But you don't really know that until you meet them and get to know them. So, I mean, why couldn't that happen here?
I don't know. I mean, I suppose it is happening.
The last time she saw him, he was a boy that foolishly challenged her lover to a duel, and they probably haven't really seen each other spoke since. So, she might assume that he's grown up and changed for the better. Like, he's the master of coin now. That's pretty respectable.
Sure.
And I have affection for, like, if like Kat's thinking, like, if we were in the same jam, I would probably try to help him out somehow. So why wouldn't he help me?
Fair enough.
It's I feel like sometimes this, it's tempting to take knowledge that you have of how things worked out.
Right.
And
hindsight.
Then, yeah, it's Captain Hindsight striking.
Sure.
Because, again, like, you know, how much trouble could have Littlefinger really got up to in River End, or River Run, rather. So that's it for the emails. Again,
okay.
GameOfThrones@baldmove.com or forums.baldmove.com if you'd like to submit your missive. And otherwise, we'll be back with the fourth episode next week.
All right. See you guys then.
All right. Bye-bye.